everyone. Welcome to Stick to Wrestling. I don't know why I have to announce the show. I mean, it's not like anyone accidentally downloaded this and needs me to identify it. But there are a lot of good wrestling podcasts out there. This is the only wicked good wrestling podcast. I am here with my friend Sean Goodwood. Sean, how are you?
So for the show, you said you wanted to talk about something regarding last week. That immediately makes me think I screwed something up.
No, not at all. Well, I mean, you totally did, but
of course I'm paranoid. So, but go ahead.
It was a big positive to the show. You brought up Ox Baker showing up. I want to say it was spring 1980 with Grand Wizard as his manager, and he lasted exactly one taping, and they sent him home. And over the years, everyone just kind of speculated that Ox, you know, he was not very good in the ring at all, and that's why he got sent home. Which is kind of weird because the WWF didn't really care that much about that. And Ox definitely had the right look for the WWF. I've come up with two additional theories. Sean, have you ever been in a room with Ox Baker?
I've never had the pleasure.
I'm not saying he's a bad guy, and I'm not disparaging him. He's not a bad guy. But Ox was unbelievably freaking loud. I mean, we're talking Dick Murdoch level of loud. And unlike Murdoch, Ox never shut up. And again, it's just his personality. It's just the way he was. But I can see Ox turning someone, you know, turning the locker room or the wrong person in the locker room off enough to be like, I don't want to be on the road with this guy, you know, 6-7 days a week.
Before you get into these additional theories, I just would like to point out the strength of the original theory and why really no one looked for additional theories for the most part, because Ox Baker was epically bad. I mean, he made Joe LeDuc look like Rey Mysterio bad. I mean, he was bad. So all you had to say was, because he was really bad? Yeah, I could see that. So, but go ahead. That's why that's so convincing, because he's just that bad.
I mean, it could have been a combination of things, but there were no shortage of guys that were exceptionally bad in the WWF. I mean, you know, and we're talking Backlund era. We're talking Big John Studd. We're talking the Hangman. We're talking Jesse Ventura. Because he's a celebrity now, he gets a break for being just absolutely horrible in the ring. But he was oh my God, Tony Atlas was bad. So I mean,
Tony Atlas was better than Ox Baker.
You're right. Ox Baker was worse, but that's something they kind of turned a blind eye to.
Fair enough, and that tells you how bad Baker was. But go ahead.
Here's the thing. It's New York. He had the size and the look for New York. So I was kind of waiting for him to come in and challenge Bruno. But number two, the next summer, 1981, John Carpenter's Escape from New York comes out, and Ox Baker has a role in it. So maybe he was offered that role and that changed things. I'm just speculating here. I don't know.
First of all, highly underrated movie. I mean, that was Kurt Russell, if memory serves, and Lee Van Cleef. If you haven't seen it, go see it. This was much better than Escape from L.A., which came out 20 years later.
Escape from L.A. doesn't exist.
Basically, New York turns into a penal colony, and the president gets stuck inside, and they got to get him out. There's a story.
And it is an awesome movie.
Russell's never been better.
No, I don't think so.
Snake Plissken.
Yeah. I thought you were dead. Yeah, it was a good movie. And, I mean, just a good memory. I mean, me, my friends, my girlfriend, all going to the Tingsboro Drive-In to go see that back in the summer of 1981. And the girlfriend's like, what did you take me to see? Oh, my God. But anyway.
Honest to God, I think you're overthinking this, man. This guy, the cat's bad. I mean, he was bad. I think Vince just walked out and goes, okay, you know what? I'm willing to accept bad, but this guy's really bad.
I'm going to be honest here. In 1980, I did not look at Ox Baker and say, wow, he's bad. I would just look at him and say, wow, look at this guy. You know, I saw him in the magazines, and he had, like I said, that look. So, I don't know. I mean,
I'm not even comparing him to Bobby. I'm not even comparing him to Bobby Backlund. I'm comparing him to guys of his ilk who kind of did what he did. Like Joe LeDuc, for example. A similar performer, wouldn't you say? The enforcer, the guy you bring in, you know. Yeah, fair enough. Is they're all similar. Joe LeDuc does rings around Ox Baker in the ring. And Joe LeDuc wasn't great.
No, Joe LeDuc wasn't great. But you know who was really bad that they brought in 82 is Blackjack Mulligan was horrible, and we noticed. I didn't
They had to be hoping the name. I agree with you. He got in the 80s, he was terrible. I remember seeing some footage of him in Florida in 85 and the punches.
Oh, God.
Oh, the punches. I couldn't get over it. I'm looking at it like, how could anybody look at this and think these are real?
Yeah.
And Jack was never great in the ring. He had the great persona.
I don't know if you know this, Jack. Blackjack Mulligan had a heart attack, I want to say early 1980. And, obviously that'll mess you up bad. And for a while, they thought his career was over. So, maybe he took a major step back. Ernie Ladd was terrible in 1978, too. So, if Ox Baker was so much worse than Blackjack Mulligan that they couldn't get by with the guy, wow.
Yeah, but Ox, again, you're kind of hoping they remember Jack because he's been there before.
It had been so long that I really believe that it was a completely different fan base. I think there was like 74, 75.
Back then, they would do that. Back then, they would reach back to something that happened 7 or 8 years ago. Now, forget it. It's a joke. They won't even go back 6 months. But, back then, they would say, remember we talked about, and I forgot, that when they brought back Stasiak. And that was a few years earlier.
No, Stasiak was still there late 73, early 74, and he came back like fall 78. Don't get me started on today. They won't stop reaching back for the skeletons of the 90s and putting Triple H and Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker in main event.
Yeah, well, that's fair enough. But they would do that, though. They would. That was one of the things I liked about the NWA, was they would reference things that happened in the past. Like when the Assassin had the whole angle with Dusty Rhodes with the El Santo mask that we talked about a few weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
That worked because, one of the many reasons it worked was because they had a history. People knew the Assassin and Dusty hated each other.
Okay, that's definitely true, but here's a counterpoint. When Stasiak came back to the WWF, you couldn't get through a Stasiak match without them mentioning he was a former WWF champion. Mulligan, as far as I remember, and I think I would have remembered, they never referenced him as a former WWF tag team champion. I don't even think they ever mentioned that he'd been there before. It's like, oh, a huge, gigantic Blackjack Mulligan. And that was it.
True, I guess. And they usually didn't try to follow the magazines either. Okay, what was your second point? I'm sorry. I'm already lengthening this segment up more than it should have been because
the
mailbag.
Those are my two points. Maybe it was escape from New York. Maybe they just got turned off by the guy's personality, or maybe he just sucked. I don't know. But Vince Sr. never, rented a plane and put out in skywriting. I dumped him because he sucked.
I'm going with the B and C combo.
Usually in life, things don't happen for just one reason, It's like, okay, this guy sucks, and we can't stand being around him.
Occam's razor. Occam's razor.
There you go. Go ahead.
I just want to give props to our guys on the website. We always kind of push the Facebook page, and I definitely want to give our guys credit here. Little inside baseball here. John and I had a conversation the other day. We just finished the three segments on 76 WWF, and we're trying to think what we wanted to do next. And John mentioned the mailbag, and I was like, we got a day left. We're not going to get the questions in time. Oh, yeah, we did. Within an hour, we had like 25 comments. So this is what happens at the Facebook page. If you're not on it, you should be. It's very interactive, and these guys were all over it. So, if we can't get to them all, our apologies. You guys are great.
Yeah, and thank you guys. And I want to say two quick things just to show you what a dope I am. We're going to do a show that is about the Facebook page, and I was going to forget to plug the Facebook page, but it's Stick to Wrestling. It's easy to find. It's a really good group. Feel free to join. So, Sean, would you like to read the first question?
Okay, you're going to have to help me out on this one.
Okay.
This one's from Adam Luce. Again, these are all from the Facebook page. Okay.
Adam Bourne
like the second. This is the second time we've done this. So we do do this occasionally. Since it's been 19 years since his passing, any memories on the Boston bad boy, Tony Rumble? Now, I was mostly a National fan. I really was kind of young when Rumble was making his name in Boston in the 80s. So I'm going to have to defer to you because I know you have a story.
I don't have a Tony Rumble story per se. I had been around him a few times. He was a fun guy to be around. Do you want to talk about just, that gimmick where he's running around wearing a Red Sox cap and a Patriots t-shirt and Celtic shorts was not a gimmick. That was him. So he was a good guy. He was fun to be around. He was an enthusiastic fan. When ICW, when he was running that, he was doing a lot of work and he was getting his family involved. Like he put his stepdaughter on TV to ask questions. So it was kind of an interesting experience being around him.
Was he a mentor of the Santos family?
I can't remember him ever mentioning them.
Okay. Because I thought he'd work with them. You know what? When I asked you there was a story, I was almost going to mark it down that you booked them. That was how the story was going to start.
No. He was just, UCW was very brief, and he, at this point, didn't want to be in the ring anymore. And not to get too UCW on everybody, but we had something printed in the newspaper that, hey, this in the Boston Herald that, hey, this promotion in New Hampshire is starting. And, if you're a wrestler, manager, referee, whatever, looking to get into it, give this number a call. Well, I got like two or three wrestlers that, wasn't aware of the promotion. I pretty much knew like the 15 guys I wanted to use. I must have gotten 80 to 100 I want to be a manager calls and letters, for people who have never done it, but everyone thinks they can do it. And, nothing against Tony. The last thing I needed was a manager.
So, so my memory, again, vague. I really was more the WWF fan. I was just getting into JCP at this point. But my memory is basically he was a fun heel.
Oh, yeah, I thought so.
Yeah, he was a fun kind of over-the-top kind of heel. And, he was a good guy, I would think, and you often saw him locally. You would see, like, the little signs on the posts advertising. And he would be there, and you'd see him advertised locally. And he was a good guy to bring in because there was no backstory. You're bringing in Tony Rumble, you know exactly what you're going to get. It's kind of like if you're bringing in Pete Doherty.
Yeah, Pete was one of my favorites. I remember he was doing commentary and Gorilla Monsoon was like, "Oh, you live close to the Boston Garden. Did you walk here?" And Darty got like all offended and excited. It's like, "No, I didn't walk. You don't need to walk places. I took the T." Hey, I think he was being totally serious. I don't think he was making a joke.
Okay, now I'm not okay. There's a ton of questions here. The guys came through first, so I'm not letting us get bogged down like we can. like the 1 hour cover 1 month.
If you sent in a question and it doesn't get answered, we're sorry. I would love to answer them all. But we've only got an hour and it's not like, don't be out there like my question wasn't good enough. It's just, we just can't.
I'm going in order. I'm honest to God. I'm going in order. And I'll tell you one step further. The ones I don't get on the air, I will answer personally.
All right. You know what? I will do my best to do that as well. Thank you for the idea. I am not going to go in order. I pick favorites.
Then I defer. I picked the first one, so I was going in the order. So go ahead.
Oh, okay. Let me see. Jose Salas Rodriguez, what is the biggest riot you ever witnessed at a wrestling show? Sean, did you ever get to a riot?
I've told this story here before. I'm going to tell it again. It really wasn't a riot. ECW was never – I had been to a lot of ECW shows. If you see any ECW show from the beginning they started promoting until pretty much Mass Transit, I think I may have gone to one after that like years later just as a – it was in Worcester and my friends asked me. But Mass Transit was pretty much it for me.
Yeah.
That was the craziest thing I've ever seen.
Is that the craziest thing you've ever seen in or out of wrestling?
Certainly in wrestling.
The guy's laying on his back, and there's a stream of blood shooting out of his head.
spurting like a fountain.
Yeah,
I will never forget.
Jumping up 4 inches.
I was in the third row.
Ugh.
I closed my eyes and I could see that. I walked out. I was like, I'm never going again. I was like, that's it. Okay. Because my thing with the ECW, I've said this here before, was the beauty of it was that you had a little bit of everything. It was like wrestling vaudeville. You'd have the brawling. Paul used everybody to their strengths. You'd have some high flying. You'd have some pure wrestling. You'd have some comedy. You know, everything, you know, that was at this point, it was just brawling. We had nothing else. And it was painful. So anyway, I'm not going to go off my ECW rant again. But I'd say the funniest one was, again, the brawls there were almost like performance art. You know, and the funniest one was, I can't remember the town hall. It was some town hall in like the middle of Massachusetts, some little local thing. And it was Raven and Sandy, 96. And they went out of the ring because they had a little stage area in the middle of the town hall. Went out of the ring, up the stairs. We're following them. There's like a fight breaking out on the way over there. Into the hallway where all the town offices are, and we're like going past the city comptroller. There's like a little ashtray right there. They knock that over, and you hear some little old woman in the back screaming, "Take it outside!" Like this happens. you know, like this occasionally happens. So I will have to say that was the, like I said, it's more performance art than a riot, but that's the best I've been through.
I have talked about the riot that Brian Lass was present for at the Louisville Gardens when we went to Smoky Mountain Fan Week back in 95. There was another one, though. This one was really – I mean, it wasn't a riot, a full-fledged riot, but it was close. 1982 in the Boston Garden, I think this was the May or the June show. Chief Day Strongbow had just returned after a three-year absence, and he was white hot. And he brings in Jules Strongbow, and they've got the tag team titles, and they're going after Fuji and Saito, who just had amazing heat. I mean, no other tag team in the Backlund era had heat like these guys. And they, you know, the match is taking place at the Boston Garden. The Strongbows, I wanted to say they were on TV just for the first time, like 3 or 4 weeks earlier. And it's a tag team title match, and everyone's, you know, on the edge of their seat. And Fuji and Saito sneak attack the Strongbows, and Fuji blinds them with salt, and the match is apparently over in like 30 seconds. And this place was coming unglued. People were trying to get into the ring. People were throwing things at the ring. And I'm sitting there, like, I don't have the greatest seats. I'm, like, in the back of the loge at the old Boston Garden. And someone threw a crushed Pepsi can into the ring. And Saito just laughs and picks it up and starts hitting Jules Strongbow with it, which is pouring, you know, gas on the flames. Well, then the Strongbows start fighting back. And they pin, I think it was Saito, and that's how we learned it was a 2 out of 3 fall match. So people thought like their big match was going to be 30 seconds long, and they were not happy.
If I may, I unfortunately was not there, but I have heard this story told so often that I feel like I was. What would you consider the famous riot in wrestling history? If you think wrestling riot, what's the first one that comes to mind?
Okay, you're going to say the Madison Square Garden one?
Yep.
The first one that came to mind for me was the Cleveland riot, because I actually got to see it on tape.
Fair enough. But the first one I thought of was 57 Madison Square Garden. Eduardo Carpentier and Rocca against Dick the Bruiser and Dr. Jerry Graham.
Okay. And that was, now, you know, an interesting read, and there were all kinds of consequences for that.
Before the match, Dr. Jerry, who at this point was a heat machine, it was just a natural thing. Remember, we were talking about this once, that certain guys, like, you have to like getting booed to be an effective heel. And Terry said another thing about it, and this is really, I mean, if you're an actor, this is the case. You got to believe you're right.
Oh, yeah.
You have to believe it's you against them, and they're all stupid. Okay, that has to be your thinking. And Dr. Jerry was brilliant at it. it was just the mocking and the taunting and he remember he had the big cigars lighting with a $100 bill and Vince, by the way, Vince McMahon's favorite wrestler.
Oh yeah.
And so he walked in with a cigar into the background, looking into the MSG audience that night. And he says, you could smell it. He goes, it was just, you know, there was some kind of energy in the air. He goes, yeah, we're going to see what we can do tonight. Now, there's all kinds of controversy of what happened, but I guarantee you Dr. Jerry started it because that's what he does. That's what he's paid to do. And he was good at it back then. And, of course, Dick the Bruiser, I'm sure, was egging everybody on. And he claimed for years that he was banned from MSG. I don't know how much I want to believe that. Looks good in the banner, doesn't it?
Actually, it does.
Yeah.
Sounds good.
So, I mean, you know, but that, I mean, when you think of riots, like big national riots, if you mention that probably will often be, because that was, they had the classic picture, I can't remember what magazine was in, maybe Time or something, where you see all three of them over at the New York Athletic Commission about to get reamed out. Bruiser,
yeah.
It's online. It's Bruiser, Dr. Jerry, and Coppedier and Rocca all sitting there, and you just Jerry's like, yeah, this is how much you can tell. He has this look of complete self-satisfaction to him. Like, yep,
you know
this
what?
Is exactly where I want to be. I am in the newspaper. Yep.
I forget who I had a conversation with about this, but it was one of the wrestlers, and I ought to remember, but I don't. It's one of the old timers. And he was like, you know, he was talking about riots, and he was like, you need to know, like, when to turn the heat up and then, like, know how to turn the heat down. And he compared it to cooking with a crock pot. He's like, if you have it on, if you don't have enough heat, the food doesn't get cooked. But if you have too much pressure, it blows up. And, mm-hmm. you know, basically, he's like, hey, you don't want to have a riot.
And Jerry had no concept of turning it down, and neither did Dick. So now you got a problem. You probably could have seen a disaster coming, putting those two together. And thinking of that, let me go into what we were talking about. I believe it was last week with Jack Vanino. Is a similar situation we're talking about here, where the emotions got out of control. They misread their crowd. They were used to an American crowd. They went down to Puerto Rico. They ran into something different.
Yeah, I've heard stories about Puerto Rico.
Oh yeah, like I said, I tell you, as much as I love Memphis, if I ever got Dutch Mantel here, we'd be talking about Puerto Rico the whole time because he was a booker there for years.
Nah. Anyway, I need to tease you right now. I got to meet Dutch Mantel, like for real, meet him and talk to him at the Lowell Memorial Auditorium back in 1991. So, what's your next question?
So, okay, next question. We will. Okay, I'll go back. Hold on, I don't want to. Who do you think is the best – this is from Carl Wardlaw. Who do you think is the best manager of all time? Who do you think the best referee of all time is?
Best manager of all time is tough. I mean, you know what? I personally always enjoyed Jim Cornette more than Bobby Heenan. And I know in some parts of the world that's sacrilege. I mean, Heenan was, and from what I understand too, I missed a lot of Heenan's best days.
That's exactly what I was going to say. I don't think we've seen a lot of him because by the time we got to see him, he was pretty injured.
Yeah. And for good reason, I saw some of the bumps he took in Chicago.
He was a pinball. Nick Bockwinkel used to say about Bobby Heenan that you could replace me or Ray, meaning Ray Stevens, with Bobby, and not one person will ask for a refund.
Yeah, Bobby was still doing bumps in the WWF,
you saw the pictures of him in the magazine.
I've seen footage of some of his bumps. He was insane.
It would be blood everywhere. And he could be in there with, it doesn't matter. He could be with a referee and he's taking some crazy bump over the ropes.
Another guy I have a growing appreciation for is Lou Albano. Through the old All-Star Wrestling stuff on the WWE Network. That guy was a nut.
Think of the flotsam and jetsam that he had to get over.
Mm-hmm.
Think of some of the guys that Lou had to get over. I mean, it wasn't like to the Grand Wizard where you were getting the best guy. Lou was pretty much getting the flotsam and the jetsam, pretty much. And he was getting them all over.
Let me give you an example. We were talking about really bad WWF wrestlers. If Bulldog Brower was could get pushed,
Undertaker.
But they're doing an interview where Albano and Brower are out there talking, and Brower starts talking, and Albano just grabs the ring bell, walks into the ring, and starts ringing the bell for, like, no reason. And I'm dying laughing. This guy was a nut.
He single-handedly kept the WWF tag team title relevant for a decade.
He did.
Okay,
so he
was
one guy. To answer the question, I'm going to go Jim Cornette.
Jimmy Hart.
And I can see Jimmy Hart.
In Memphis. I have to say in Memphis, but I won't take away from – I can't – you know, he did what he was given in, you know, New York. He did what he could. I saw the best of Jimmy Hart, and I haven't seen better. He was the heel side of Memphis for 5 years. If what happens that he – okay, here. What happens to Memphis if Jimmy can't get over? In 1980,
they would have some serious problems. You know who would scare Jimmy Hart to? In the old Batman reruns, it was like Batman against the Joker, and the Joker would have like five henchmen, and like, you know, Batman and Robin would just beat up the henchmen. It didn't matter. It was like Jimmy Hart was the Joker, and the guys behind him were just, you know, all these dudes wearing these like weird uniforms.
Look at the roster of some of the people that Jimmy had. My God. It didn't matter. See, this was one of the strengths that Jerry had to deal with, which was that he understood that I can bring in some guys and take some chances because Jimmy's going to get them over.
That's actually a really good point. Some of the talent, if you want to call it that Jimmy Hart got stuck with, I mean, you're right. Wow.
Chick Donovan.
He
damn near got Chick Donovan over.
I think Chick Donovan is one of the more overrated guys out there. He was pretty terrible.
He's dead weight. He's a very poor man, Ric Flair. I mean, I don't know the way, he tried to be Ric Flair but failed. You know, he's Ric Flair without the charisma or the agility.
Ric Flair without the anything.
Yeah, all the good stuff. Take all the good stuff out of Ric, and that's Ric. And you got Chick Donovan.
You know what? That's a good way of looking at it. I mean, Chick really couldn't do anything. I mean,
Jimmy damn near got him over.
Yeah. All right. So you're going with Hart. I'm going with Cornette. Yep. I think there are a lot of different guys in the argument.
Sure. I mean, you could say Bobby Davis, who was one of the greats from the old time. You know, with the Grahams and with Buddy Rogers. So yeah, you can go way back. Red Berry, back then.
Oh yeah.
So, yeah, there are a lot of names over a lot of years. So, okay, your turn.
All right, this is a multi-part question. So you and I, probably some of these, we have to just keep it to, like, you know, just the name of the person. Neil Shockett says, what heel wrestlers from the 70s territories that never made it to the WWF pre-expansion did you want to show up, and which manager, Blassie, Wizard, or Albano, would you pair them with? My friends and I used to play this game all of the time during the Backlund era and the Bruno era.
Joe LeDuc, Albano.
Let me see. Well, he actually gave us a list. You know what? I would go Joe LeDuc, Blassie. Because, you know, Blassie got the foreign guys, and I could see him with Albano, too.
I guess, but he's so nuts. He kind of would fit in with Joe was so nuts, he would fit in beautifully with Lou.
You know what? It makes sense. I could totally see it. I would just go, you know, if I was like 51% Blassie, 49% Albano.
Sure.
All right. Here's the list. Abdullah the Butcher.
Not three. You're not getting three out of him.
Oh, no. I'm just saying, like, which manager would you put him with?
Oh, I'm sorry. Which one would I put him with? I was thinking when I bring him in. Abdullah. That's Blassie.
He's so perfect for the WWF, yet he's so odd and like you can't do it. It's a weird combination.
Kabuki, Blassie.
Oh, who would you stick with Abdullah?
Blassie.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I would with Abdullah. I'm going Captain Lou Albano.
Really?
All things being considered,
God, he has Blassie written all over him.
That was exactly
the guy that Blassie would get when he came in.
Well, you know, he's from Sudan, so there's the pro Blassie. he's a complete nut. So there's the pro Albano.
Let me provide a differentiation here. Are we talking about who you think he would have gone with, or who you think he should have gone with?
Who he should have gone with.
Okay, so there's our differentiation. I'm going to say Albano each time because I love Albano. He's by far my favorite of that bunch, including Wizard. You know, whatever. He is the. I'm going to say Albano each time just because I like him that much. But I would say in this case, who we should. Yeah, I'm going to say Lou again. But he would end up with Fred.
The Great Kabuki.
I'm going to say Lou each time, but Fred.
There was a plan. There was a, I don't know if it was a plan or an idea or a plan that fell through to bring Kabuki in like late 82, early 83, and put him with Lou Albano and feud the Great Kabuki with Jimmy Snuka. I don't know if that's just like a fake story or something fell through. Obviously, it didn't happen. But I mean, if you brought in Kabuki without the, you know, the Albano storyline, I mean, he's a Fred Blassie guy all the way.
Plus, but keep in mind that if you bring in Kabuki, more than likely Gary's coming with him, because Gary was his real life manager.
Yeah, and you know what? Oh, you might have just hit the nail on the head, because I was about to say the McMahons weren't going to put up with that. They weren't going to have Gary Hart mess with their formula, so maybe that's what happened.
Yeah, it's possible.
All right, Pac Song.
That's Blassie.
Blassie.
Again, Blassie, who do I think he would go with? Blassie. Who should he go with? Albano. I'm going to say Albano each time.
Except
for the next one.
All right. I'm going to say Pac Song would have wound up with Blassie because, again, Blassie got the guys who weren't from the United States. But I have this bizarre picture in my head of Pac Song standing next to the Grand Wizard. I don't know why. Maybe it's like he's standing in Ernie Ladd's place or something. Next up, Nick Bockwinkel.
Ernie Roth.
I mean, there's 100% on that one.
Yeah.
Gino Hernandez.
That's interesting. By the way, just to give an explanation, the reason I said Nick Bockwinkel in that one was because whenever you had a big-time guy, you would put him with Ernie.
And plus, I mean, I could not picture Nick Bockwinkel with Lou Albano and forget about that. And Blassie,
yeah.
I just don't see it.
Yeah, I mean, but when you saw him with somebody with Ernie, you already understood main event guy.
Yeah, totally. That's, I mean, with the way we used to say it when we were kids, you know, Albano gets the tag team, Blassie gets like the foreign geeks, and Wizard gets the guys who are good.
Right. Gino Hernandez, with that in mind, oh, geez, Gino. None of the above. Wizard, I guess?
I can't see him with Albano. The Wizard a little bit, but for whatever reason, I see him as a Fred Blassie guy.
Okay. Yeah. The Grappler.
The Grappler. Now, let me say this. The Grappler was over to me in like 1980 because I got Mid-South on cable, and he's North American champion successfully defending against guys like Orndorff, DiBiase, and JYD.
Just for those who don't know, who is the Grappler?
Len Denton.
Yeah.
Okay.
Very, very over in Portland.
Yes, he was. If he came up here and they gave him a one-and-done at Madison Square Garden, oh, man, I don't see a perfect fit with anybody, but I would go with Fred Blassie ultimately.
I guess.
The
last two I'm going to put together because I probably have the same guy because they both remind me of each other. Carl Cox and Dick Murdoch. I want to see them both with Lou. I think they would both be hysterical with Lou.
Yeah, I see both of them with Lou, too.
Because they'll push back. So they'll have like an interplay with Lou as opposed to Lou just plowing over the guy.
You know what? And I'm going with Lou Albano, but I want to throw this in. It's a little bit off the question. Dick Murdoch had a great run in Crockett early 1988 with Jim Cornette as his manager. And it looked like he was just going to get super over, main event guy. And then he went to Japan. And then when he came back, he was with Paul Jones. And you know how that went. Without even knowing, you know.
If Dick is interested, he's getting over. Okay, Dick's just a smart guy. He's a smart wrestling guy who he can get into a ring, look around, read the crowd quickly, and know how to get over when he's interested. You know how, you know, stuff happens occasionally that sometimes he's not as interested as, you know, usual. But if he comes in with his head right, I'm convinced that Dick could get over whenever he wanted to.
Yeah, I mean, he came in 86, and he was, you know, just another guy for Ric Flair. Didn't have a lot of fire as a babyface. And then they turned him against Dusty, and again, nothing really happened. But
look at the setup each time.
They put him with Cornette. I mean, I guess Cornette lit a fire under the guy. So they were great together.
That's what I'm saying. That was probably the difference in that one time. All of a sudden Dick gets interested, and that's probably why they put him with Cornette.
And heaven knows why they took him away from Cornette.
That's a whole other problem, yeah. But, I mean, I would agree, because I'm convinced that Dick is that smart that he can get over wherever he is very quickly as long as he's interested. Yeah.
All right. Your question, sir.
Oh, you and you're going out of order here. Now I'm all messed up. Okay. Okay. From Ron Gamble. Looking at the late 70s champions of Backlund, Bobby Backlund, Harley Race, and Nick Bockwinkel, which of them do you think would have fit in better as champion of another organization, and why?
Okay, I would say that Bob Backlund would have made for a successful NWA champion. The other ones, I don't really see it at all. I don't see Harley Race as AWA or certainly not WWF champion. I think a lot of people might say, oh, Nick Bockwinkel, WWF, you know, it's just not a fit as a champion anyway. There was a story out there maybe 30 years ago that Nick Bockwinkel was offered a run with the NWA title in like 79. I don't think, and I'll correct that story, I don't know if the NWA fans would have bought Nick Bockwinkel, because by that time he was looking kind of old, but then again, so was Harley Race. And I mean, I definitely know that story is not 100% true. Paul Bosch asked Nick Bockwinkel, do you want, you know, where the convention's coming up, would you like to be considered for the NWA championship? And Nick kind of said, no, I'm good where I am. So he turned down being considered for it, not actually getting it.
Allow me to address the first two before I mail my love letter to the late great Wicked Nick Bockwinkel. I think Bob would fit in well in the AWA at that time period.
I think about it, you're right. He would have been he almost would have been perfect.
Yeah, I think he would have been great there. NWA. He can't tween. Maybe he could. I don't know. When he did become heel years later, he did it pretty easily. I don't know if he could have done it back then, though.
I think he, you know what? Jack Briscoe did it, and we talked about that last week.
True. So with that proviso, because he would be very good as a champion because he is more impressive physically than he looks.
That is true.
He does not look as massively strong as he is. So you could kind of slip some guy in there, know you're covered, know he can kind of turn it on and off when need be. So yeah, I think he'd be a very good NWA champion. Now to Nick. Nick can be whatever he wants to be. There are certain wrestlers in the industry, not a lot of them, Ric Flair, Buddy Rogers, wherever they go, they're going to go to the top just because that's the kind of guy they are. I mean, that's the kind of performer they are. They're just that good. I think Nick would make whatever adjustments he needed to be. And when is the last time in Nick's career he's been anything but in the upper part of the card?
Wherever
he's been, whether it's Georgia or wherever.
When he was AWA Tag Team Champion, that's near the top of the card, but it's not, you know, at the top of the card.
Yeah, fair enough. But, I mean, that was as prestigious as the AWA Tag Team title ever was. It was in
Very
the early
true.
70s. And a big reason for that was them.
You know, the more – true. I mean, we're talking about arguably the greatest tag team in history. The more I think about it, Bob Backlund would have been a perfect AWA champion. He has the amateur background. He wrestled at either North Dakota or North Dakota State. I forget. He was from Minnesota. He was straight from the Gagne mold. So, yeah, he would have been a great AWA champion.
So, yeah, but I think whatever role you want to put Nick in, he's going to succeed because he's just that kind of guy. He's going to get over because he does. That's what he does.
Yeah, you know what? I just don't see him in New York. I guess, you know, we agree.
He would be Million Dollar Man before he was Million Dollar Man.
Yeah, I'll tell you what. Had he been 10 years earlier, he would have been an interesting choice, to say the least.
I think he may have been better.
All right. Kevin Dignam wants to know, what do you consider the biggest work in wrestling history? And I got a clarification from him. I mean, like, the one that people actually believed. He's like, yeah, so what do you think?
The biggest work. Do we mean something? It has to be the title match, right? The match between Hart and the Screwjob, right?
Well, I mean, I thought about that one. I mean, that wasn't a work, but you're right. There are still.
Oh, okay. Let me define. What exactly? I can't find the question. What exactly are we talking about? As far as, like, you know, what are we looking at here?
I mean, something that, you know, something that was a work that people believe was real. Or
okay,
legit,
so a work shoot.
I mean, I'm not looking at it that way. But, I mean, you're right. There are still people out there who will tell you that, the Montreal was a work. Like, no, it wasn't. It's like,
okay, I understand
not
now.
A work.
I would say Pitbull 1's broken neck. Not, like, after he got better. Not when
it
happened.
That's a good one.
When they did the thing where Shane kind of shook his halo and everyone freaked out.
Oh, my jaw dropped.
Yeah.
I mean, and so did everyone in the crowd. That was that was the greatest wrestling reaction I've ever seen.
To ECW's credit, they actually were very good at this. They did another one with Sandman where he accidentally got blinded. And they sold this well, where they had the baby faces yelling at Bobby too, Tommy too. He got accidentally blinded because of a messed up cane shot or something. And like when he was, you know, a lot of the shows were local. You did not see the Sandman in Philadelphia.
No, that's the only way you can do it.
He stayed home.
Yeah, I you're right. That's the only way you can do it with that crowd. Yeah. I mean, they almost killed Junkyard Dog one day when he was supposed to be blinded. And it was like a hot day in Louisiana, and he shows up at the office and watches, like, you know, okay, they made him drive home on a hot day in Louisiana. And, you know, this is Louisiana heat in Grizzly Smith's trunk because they didn't want anyone seeing Junkyard Dog out and about.
Yeah. So
I consider the biggest work in wrestling history Andre the Giant being 7'4". And people, to this day, people believe that.
Okay, so you're talking about like a work as far as like something along the lines of, you know, someone's physical attribute or something like that.
Not necessarily, but I mean, that to me, that's the biggest work that
could,
people always believed.
Yeah. I mean that was thoroughly believed for a long time.
Yeah, it was. I mean, everyone just accepted it, and supposedly. Will Chamberlain wanted to meet Andre the Giant, and Andre like ran as fast as he could away from Will Chamberlain because Will Chamberlain towered over him.
Yeah, Will was a legit 7'2".
So, all right, bud, your question.
Okay, and okay, Kevin Urquhart, what are your top? We'll call this a reason to bring up Buddy Rose. Who are your top five underrated? Kevin loves him some Buddy Rose. And you know what? God bless. I do too. I mean, for what he did, he was fantastic. Who are your top five underrated, overlooked workers of all time? Here's my list. 1, Buddy Rose. 2, Tiger Conway Jr. Ed. 3, Wiskowski. We have a significant Portland. John Tolos. 5, Chavo Guerrero Sr. Honorable mention, Bull Ramos.
I have to see more Bull Ramos. I have not seen enough of him. If he's being, you know, put in that rarefied air. Tolos I really liked, you know, as much as I've seen of him. If I had to do a top five, and we talked about this on a show, I don't know, a long time ago, Bruiser Brody, to me, gets so much flack for being overrated that he is now
good
underrated.
Lord. Good.
I'm telling you, man.
So now you're going to go on this thing, get him overrated again, so all of us have to come back and, like, smack it down again to back to something reasonable.
I have that kind of power.
Yeah, the 15, you know, with the 17-time whatever award. You get. Oh, my God, Brody. Get out of here with you, Brody. Okay, this is going to be the Memphis list. Bill Dundee.
Good pick.
Yeah, I love Bill Dundee. He just gets over. I mean, you know, it's and he's there is no reason he should be getting over.
Another guy on my list, Ted DiBiase. I think to this now he does not get enough credit for being one of the greatest in ring performers I've ever laid eyes on.
He's tremendous. In the early 80s, he may have been the best. I mean, he could do whatever. What did you want to do? I mean, he could do whatever you wanted. He was a fantastic face. He wasn't just a good face. He was a fantastic face. And you see, whenever you see, like, when you see Rick, when you see, like, Rick, you'll sit there, and he's a face. He's a good face, but you'd rather see Rick as a heel. Even when he's a face, he's kind of like a heel.
Rick, you know what? Ooh, talk about underrated. Rick is an underrated babyface. You should have seen him in the Carolinas in, you know, like 1980, late 1979.
He's very good.
Phenomenal.
But there's a certain, you can tell Rick thoroughly enjoys being a heel. There's a certain kind of thing. Yeah, well, yeah. That's what I'm saying. But Ted can do either with ease.
Yeah, he was great at both. Ted might have been the greatest heel I've ever seen, not as the Million Dollar Man, but Mid-South Ted DiBiase. And going off the trail a little bit, you just mentioned that Rick liked being a heel. Yeah, that was a problem because there was a time when Rick absolutely positively needed to be turned babyface. And after he finally did it, he lasted as a babyface for less than a year. Because he likes being a heel. Well, you got to do what's best for the promotion. If you like being a second baseman, but you're a pitcher, pitch.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
All right. Anyone else you want to bring up?
Let's see. Who else do I want to? Yeah, I'll throw in a couple guys who. Dutch Mantel.
Okay.
I think he's another one of these guys who gets over. I will put. I shall throw in Dick Murdoch and Carl Cox. Guys who just, they're right below great. No, they're not. They're actually great. Just because there's not a lot of footage of them, it doesn't mean they're not great. And here's another one you just brought up, Dr. Jerry Graham. He does not get the love that he deserves as one of the great performers the industry has ever produced. So.
Okay. I will go with three more. I will agree with Kevin on Chavo Guerrero Sr. I am going to say I have a weird one. I thought Jerry Valiant was very underrated. And maybe it's just because Johnny and Jimmy were so bad, but he could actually get in there and halfway carry a match.
Hold on. Let me just pull my jaw up off my lap here for a second. What?
Hey, it's
Johnny Valiant.
No, Jerry Valiant.
Oh, Jerry. Yeah, no, okay. Jerry, I thought you said Johnny. I'm sorry. That's where I nearly like passed out there for a second. Jerry is. No, absolutely.
Okay.
Jerry can work in the ring.
And one final guy. Let me see. I just had his name on the top of my pointy little head, and I forgot it. Oh, Sam Houston was on the verge of stardom at one point in Mid-South, and they sold the company, and no one wanted to push him. But Sam Houston was getting really, really good late 86, early 87.
He needed to gain about 50 pounds.
Huh?
He needed to gain about 50 pounds.
He, you know what? By this point, he was getting bigger. In 85, yeah, the guy was a shoestring, but
he looked very similar to Barry Windham in like 1981.
Exactly. And Barry Windham filled out, and Sam Houston did actually fill out in like 89, 90 when he was with the WWF.
Okay. I think that was pretty much as much as you're going to get out of them. I think they used him well that year, too.
Yeah, I think, you know, had Watts not sold out or had someone else believed in him, I mean, there was a... I think it's more than a rumor. Supposedly, Dusty Rhodes frowned on his relationship with Baby Doll and at that point just was not going to push Sam Houston, and he was never... a, you know, WWF type to push, despite they brought him in, used him as like a lower card guy. All right, so Rob McCabe, Wow, we're okay. I knew this show was going to fly by. We've got like 10 more minutes. How would you guys have rebooked? This is from Rob McCabe. How would you guys have rebooked the WWF title situation in 1997 in order to avoid having to screw Bret Hart? Would you have booked a different title match? Would you have Bret drop the title to a different wrestler? Would you have even given Bret that fifth world title run? Any thoughts, Sean?
Put him in with The Undertaker. Give it to him.
Well, that was one possibility. And here's the thing. You have to remember that Bret had in his contract reasonable creative control, which means that if it's, you know, reasonable is the adjective. He had creative control, and you kind of had to go along with what he wanted to do. And Rob has the answer right here. Would you have even given Bret that fifth world title run? Well, no, I definitely would have made sure that that title was off of him before I decide, if I'm Vince McMahon, I say, I'm going to breach your contract and send you to WCW, which, by the way, is not how it works. You don't just say, oh, I've breached your contract. I no longer have to comply with this contract. Don't you know, that was ridiculous. But one thing I would have made sure that the title was off of Bret. But let's say it's too late for that. Bret had offered at one point to lose the title either at a four-way on Raw right before he left for WCW, or he was willing to lose it to Shawn at a house show. He just didn't want to lose it to Shawn in Canada. So I would have been like, okay, Bret, lose it on a house show in the United States. They had a show in Detroit he was willing to lose the title at. And at some point, that was off the table with Bret. He, you know, towards the end, he was just like, look, I just want to go on Raw and give up the title and let that be it. And I can see McMahon saying, no, we're doing the screw job before I do that. But I would have liked to avoid doing the screw job. And I would have just had Bret lose to Shawn in Detroit while that was on the table.
Oh, I don't think they wanted to avoid doing it at all. I think that's fallacy. I think that's what they want to say. I think that's what they want you to believe, because it looks bad if they say the other. But no. There were many places where this could have been avoided. I think this is exactly what they wanted. It was perfect. It worked out beautifully for them, didn't it?
It worked out beautifully for them. But
was that a coincidence?
That's like, you know, I've got 20 at the blackjack table, and I say hit, and it turns out to be an ace. I mean,
this was the plan all along. Look, as they're approaching, they're putting little moments here and there where they can go back and go, you know, we tried. You know, I mean, we did the best we could. We tried to, you know, reason with him. He was being unreasonable. We have this clause. This was the plan all along. They wanted this. They knew it was going to be a huge story. They didn't think, and this is an insult to Hart, they didn't think he was going to get over down south.
Well, I don't know. I mean, by that point, WCW was a national company, so it kind of didn't matter. But I mean,
I don't think they thought, yeah, that's fine. You're going to have the instant splash, and it's going to last. That's fine. I don't think he thought he was going to get over in Atlanta.
Well, I mean, Vince would have been the only one. I mean, they just blew it with Bret Hart. He could have easily gotten over.
Well,
but look at it this way. Jim Cornette has talked about being part of the WWF creative while this was going on. And, you know, I believe Jim, you know, Vince is like, well, maybe we can do this, maybe we can do that. And supposedly Cornette is the one who suggested, it was towards the end, I believe, you know, why don't we just do a screw job on the guy if he won't do business?
Yes, but I mean, if you're going to do that, you can't announce it. You can't let a lot of people know about it. You'd want to say something to Jim Cornette, you know. Then you're on the record of sitting there saying, this isn't a good idea, you know.
No, I mean, that's...
You're giving deniability up and down the line here. It just worked out too perfectly. It was perfect. The second this happens, it turned into a springboard. They flip Vince immediately.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like the whole plan just went right into play. Everything was just set up perfectly. So this was all an accident that they happened to respond to quickly?
Yeah, I do think that. I do think, and one thing that I think that they planned out was Vince going into the locker room, you know, and Brett basically Vince, I think, had it in his head that he was going to provoke Brett, which he did. The line Dave Meltzer used, Brett hit Vince with a punch that would have knocked out a rhino. And I think, you know, that way Vince has a little bit of leverage too. But as far as the rest of it goes, I really think that it was just dumb luck. And this really could have backfired because a lot of the roster was upset that, you know, something like that could, if it could happen to Brett, it could happen to me. And just because something worked out well, it doesn't mean it was a good idea or it wasn't poorly planned. I get why they did it, but I would have avoided that.
If you are playing from a position,
right, it totally worked out. You are correct there.
If you are playing from a position of strength, you never do something like this. Because you're right. There is a chance this does not go well. They were not playing from a position of strength at that point.
No, not at all. Brett had,
I mean, they were in trouble.
Control.
Yeah, well, I don't even mean that. I mean, all just period.
Oh, yeah, that company was on the ropes. And my take on it was when I first started hearing that, you know, Brett was on his way to WCW, I didn't know a lot of the other stuff going on, but I was like, okay, if the WWF can't afford to keep Bret Hart, who can they afford to keep? Because he was the biggest star.
Now, with that said, I think that, you know, if he could, he would have kept Bret. I think he thinks Bret could, he likes Bret. I think he likes Bret, and I think he would have, you know, I think he felt he could get over a little bit. It's like Bill Belichick looking at the roster like, okay, that's just, that number's too big. I can't, that just number's just too big. It doesn't equate to the, it was like what happened to Malloy. I remember in Michael Hawley's book, they talked about this, where he was looking at Malloy right before he got cut. And they were saying, you know, I just can't, he's fine, but I can't do that number. And that's why they did it. So it's the same thing here with Brett. The problem here is I think he would have kept him if he could, but just couldn't do it. But I don't think he felt he could get over down south.
No, they,
long term.
They wanted to get rid of Brett. Vince had, Brett and Sean were not getting along. They literally got into a locker room brawl. By the way, I don't know what Shawn Michaels is thinking, you know, thinking he could fight Bret Hart. Brett was really, I get it. He has creative control in his contract, but he was saying no to everything. And the WWF wanted to go in a different direction. And if you look at 1998, 1999 WWF, it's a lot different than 96, 97 WWF. And I mean, Brett's on record. He didn't like a lot of the salacious stuff that they were doing.
That's all fair, but that kind of goes back to my point. And if you're going to the, quote, attitude era, what better way to do it than having this wildly controversial moment to kick it off?
I mean, I could see that. But they were already steering into the attitude era, and it was just like, you know, Brett,
he's
not wanting to do stuff. You know, they would like
Vince. Vince is a P.T. Barnum at heart. He's a self-promoter.
Yes.
Him and Trey, the same guy. Okay? So this is something P.T. Barnum would do. It's exactly what he would do. He would do something that would be loud. It could backfire, I guess, but we're going to play the odds. You're not playing from a position of strength. Roll the dice here. See what happens. I think it's going to work out. I think maybe he didn't tell a lot of people, but I think it was in the back of his head that this is where I'm going with it.
I mean, maybe – as soon as Jim Cornette brought up the idea to him, when they were still, you got to remember, they were at the point where, okay, how are we going to get the title off of Brett so that he can go to WCW because he's leaving? I think it was November 19th was the official date he was going to appear on Nitro, if I remember correctly. So I don't think it was their plan from the beginning, although it may have Vince, when Cornette suggested it to Vince, it might have been Vince is like, okay, I love this idea. And at some point,
yeah,
it's what he was doing.
Okay, so who are the guys in the room at this point?
The
Cornette, who else?
Let me see. I know Russo knew about it. I know Cornette knew about it. Vince, obviously. Triple H knew about it. Michaels knew about it. The ref knew about it. I really think that's it.
Okay. So now, if you wait long enough with him,
Patterson
with Brett still holding the belt, eventually somebody's going to say, we got to screw him. Because you got to screw him. You can't let him walk out the door with the belt. You can't.
No, I don't think you could. He was never going to walk out the door with the belt. What Brett wanted to do towards the end, this was basically all Brett was doing. You know, the I'll lose it in Detroit thing was off the table. He wanted to go on Raw with the belt, thank everybody, and hand the belt over. And Vince,
yeah.
You know, and Vince acted like he was going along with that, but
yeah.
No point was Vince going along with that.
No, of course. Eventually, you know, an old school thinker like Jim Cornette is going to say, we got to get the belt off of him by any means necessary. You know he's going to say it.
Anyone was saying that. I really don't.
You don't think that? Well, you just said Jim Cornette said that. We got to get the belt off him.
Right. But if I understand what you're saying is that they kind of said, okay, let's wait until Jim Cornette suggests this.
Oh, no. Of course not. I'm just saying this is another moment to have somebody else bring it up and it not be us. It's another layer of cover. I'm just saying at some point, you know one of these guys is going to bring it up. Because that's what they do. They're wrestling guys. They think in these terms. And they're thinking, we got to get the belt off the guy. And if we're running out of time, we got to screw him. At some point, you know someone's going to bring it up.
It was just one of those things that it was unthinkable at the time. It really was. I mean, it was Cornette because Cornette is, such an amazing historian that, he's the one who knew about what happened back in the day and how guys would eventually, get screwed on or occasionally, like back in the way Carney days, they would do something like that.
Maybe this is why Cornette was brought into the quote loop.
Provide
cover.
That one thing, I don't know about that.
Provide your
cover. Anyway, we are out of time as usual. This thing flew by, and I'm looking for one last question that I want to answer. Someone asked me, and forgive me for not mentioning your name, but I cannot find it. Someone asked me what the kookiest compilation tape I ever made for someone was. And this was, I want to say, 2002, 2003. Someone asked me for every single Honky Tonk Man clip and match I had, and I did it for him. And it was like $400-something, and the guy coughed it up, and I made a whole bunch of tapes, and it was not very much fun doing because I'm not a big Honky Tonk fan, Honky Tonk Man fan. But anyway, thank all of you for listening, and we will catch you next week. Have a good week.